Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. I'm very pleased to welcome you to tonight's special event with Mrs. Corina Casanova, the Federal Chancellor of Switzerland. Tonight's event is co-organized by the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California. I'm Morris Hirsch, the General Counsel of Union Bank and a trustee of the World Affairs Council of Northern California. Let me quickly give a brief description of each of our sponsoring organizations tonight. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where policymakers, heads of state, business executives, philanthropists, academics, civic leaders, and an attentive public engage in issues of international importance. The Commonwealth Club of California is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, bringing together its more than 16,000 members for over 400 annual events on topics ranging across politics, culture, society, and the economy. To learn more about each organization on the internet, please visit the Commonwealth Club at www.commonwealthclub.org and the World Affairs Council at www.itsyourworld.org. It's now my distinct honor to introduce this evening's distinguished guest, Mrs. Corina Casanova, Federal Chancellor of Switzerland. Mrs. Casanova has held the office of Federal Chancellor since January of 2008, following her election by the Swiss Parliament in December 2007. She studied law at the University of Fribourg, completing her studies in 1982 with a Master of Law. In 1984, she was appointed to the bar in Canton Graubünden. I hope I pronounced that reasonably well. After which, she spent 2 years working at a law practice. Between 1986 and 1990, she was a delegate for the International Committee of the Red Cross in South Africa, Angola, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. In 1992, Corina Casanova was appointed delegate for information at the Parliamentary Services of the Federal Assembly. Prior to her election as Federal Chancellor, she served as Vice Chancellor and Deputy Secretary General of the Federal Department of Foreign Affairs. The Federal Chancellor acts as Chief of Staff of the Swiss government, referred to as the Federal Council. She supports the Federal Council and the President of the Swiss Confederation, one of the seven members of the Federal Council, who also chairs the government in the performance of their duties. Mrs. Casanova also executes tasks related to the Parliament vested in her by the Constitution and the law. As Chief of Staff, the Chancellor attends the weekly meetings of the Federal Council in a consultative capacity, but also has the right to table motions. She ensures that formal requirements are adhered to. Moreover, she is responsible for the communication of the government. In certain areas, she even plays a leading role, for example, in relation to political rights, Switzerland's official languages, or the publication of legislation and official documents. Today, she will be discussing the Swiss system of direct democracy, said to be the most extensive in the world, and she will draw comparisons between the Swiss and U.S. constitutions, particularly with regard to state institutions, direct democracy, people's rights, and federalism. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Federal Chancellor of Switzerland, Mrs. Corina Casanova.
Ladies and gentlemen, the opportunity to address the Californian Commonwealth Club is not only a great honor, but also represents a very exciting occasion for me. Switzerland, with its different cultures and language regions, requires a very particular framework. Switzerland needs a great ideal of individuality in order to function, and it needs a great deal of mutual tolerance and understanding on the part of the various groups within the population. Switzerland tackles these challenges with its distinctive form of federalism. With its 7.7 million inhabitants, Switzerland is made up of 26 of very different sizes. The most populous of our cantons is the canton of Zurich, with some 1.3 million inhabitants. The smallest canton is Appenzell-Innerrhoden, with a mere 15,500 inhabitants. Its population is 86 times smaller. The various language regions also vary greatly in Switzerland. We have four national languages. Roughly 64% of our population speak German, a good 20% speak French, some 6.5% speak Italian, and 0.5% speak Romansh, that is my mother tongue. A further 9% have a different mother tongue. The language I am speaking now is among these 9%. So, given this situation, how do we manage to function as a whole? How, given such discrepancies, can we prevent larger groups from dominating the smaller ones? How can we ensure considerate interaction? How can we protect minorities? What holds us together as a country? Our cantons have a lot of autonomy. Our federalistic structures, which are enshrined in the federal constitution, guarantee this. We apply the principle of subsidiarity, whereby the federal government may only carry out those tasks which are explicitly assigned to it by the constitution. Public health and education, for example, are in the hands of the cantons. In the school system, this ensures that the cultural and linguistic character of each canton is preserved. At the national level, there are a host of other measures that serve to achieve balance. The difference in financial power between agglomerations with high value creation and the less affluent mountain regions, for example, is reduced through a system of financial equalization. The Swiss Parliament is also based on the principle of equalization. We have two equal chambers. In the National Council, cantons are represented in proportion to the number of inhabitants. The largest canton holds 35 of the chamber's 200 seats, while the smallest holds just a single seat as the guaranteed minimum. In the Council of States, on the other hand, state being another word for a canton, in our cantonal chamber or senate, each canton has two seats. Every law has to be passed by both chambers. No chamber has seniority. Direct democracy is highly developed in Switzerland. Any amendment to the constitution requires a mandatory referendum, but in order to be adopted, it has to achieve a double majority, a majority of the popular vote and a majority of the cantons. A group of smaller cantons can therefore overrule a popular majority. Protecting minorities means then that smaller communities enjoy a certain advantage over larger ones. In Switzerland, the larger communities are able to endure this without too much trouble. This generosity is the piece of successful coexistence, a pleasant prize which the smaller groups acknowledge with gratitude. Of course, I'm now being overly sentimental. Indeed, the minorities in Switzerland are not always delighted with their minority status. As you can see, we are a great pains in our country to find balance everywhere. We strive to solve conflicts through consensus and compromise. Even our system of government is based on equation. The seven members of the Federal Council represent the most important and strongest parties. At present, there are five different parties accounting for more than 75% of the popular vote. The president is merely primus inter pares and changes every year. He or she cannot take decisions or govern alone. The Federal Council decides as a collegial body. The government and parliament are therefore required to seek solutions capable of finding a majority in parliament and among the people. This leaves no room for extreme solutions, only well-balanced solutions backed by all. As the government chief of staff of a sovereign state, I am visiting one of the 50 member states of the world's number one superpower. And this member state is 10 times larger in area than my homeland and has five times as many inhabitants. It is only when it comes to the highest mountain that we in Switzerland come out on top with the Dufourspitze, with 15,203 feet, which is 708 feet higher than California's Mount Whitney, with 114,494 feet. But coming out on top doesn't really count. For if we take the lowest point, Switzerland, the shores of Lake Maggiore at 633 feet, and California with the Death Valley with 282 feet below sea level, then California has the greatest difference in height. So, how can I present Switzerland to California? As small is beautiful. That may be a bit predictable, but it may just do the trick. Now, to compare Switzerland with the USA or with California may be a bit presumptuous, but it is interesting to try. For in fact, the huge US and the tiny Switzerland have influenced each other in more than one respect. First of all, both countries are, in their slightly different ways, federal states. And it is interesting to note that the United States and Switzerland are by far the two most stable federal states in modern times. The US since 1787 and Switzerland since 1848. As such, they are prime examples against the widespread theory that federal states are transitional systems which follow the collapse of centralized states, or that they enable a federation of states to transform itself into a centralized state. That is, this theory holds in many places, can be shown when we consider that since the French Revolution in 1789, almost half of the 195 independent countries in the world today were at one time organized as federal states, but today only 23 federal states are left. So the US and Switzerland are stable federal states. But what is the explanation for this shared federal stability? It can't have anything to do with size, for the US and Switzerland are as different in size as one could possibly imagine. It could be argued that it is the large number of member states in the US and Switzerland that has made both countries particularly stable as federal states. The reason why there is federal stability in numbers is because the more member states a state has, the smaller the risk that the same population groups or the same member states will always find themselves in the minority. It is remarkable that among the world's federal states, those that have fewer than six member states have the most serious problems with internal cohesion, a problem that is most apparent in federal states with only two or three member states. In these states, linguistic, ethnic, or religious conflicts are particularly difficult to resolve. While the US number 50 member states, most of which are very large, Little Switzerland has just a bit more than half as many, 26 to be precise. In terms of its surface area, Switzerland is the fourth smallest federal state in the world, but at the same time, it is the federal state with the fourth largest number of member states. In Switzerland, which is a tenth the size of California, any of the 26 member states or cantons, as we call them, are on average smaller than California's 58 counties. One could go so far as to say, in Switzerland, a new canton begins around the corner of just about every second house. Would this mean small is beautiful? Absolutely. Now, if direct democracy in Switzerland guarantees equality before the law and a clear say in government, then federalism guarantees a maximum amount of freedom. Let me illustrate this by taking the example of our languages. In Switzerland, four languages are spoken: German, French, Italian, and Romance. Of the 26 cantons, four are exclusively French-speaking, one only Italian. One has three official languages: German, Italian, and Romance. This is the canton of Graubünden-Grisen, where I come from. Three have two official languages, German and French, and 17 cantons are German-speaking. But everyone in Switzerland is allowed to use a national language of their choice when dealing with the federal authorities. The demographic distribution of languages in California and in Switzerland incidentally shows fascinating similarities. In California, the largest language group is English-speaking with just over 60%. In Switzerland, the German-speaking population represents a similar majority with 64%. The first and largest minority language in California is Spanish with around 26%. In Switzerland, it is French-speaker with just over 20%. A similar picture emerges when we look at the distributions of the third and fourth minority languages. Chinese in California and Italian in Switzerland, or Tagalog and Romance, respectively. However, it is not only the area of demographics of language distribution that show parallels. There are remarkable parallels in terms of political rights. These similarities stem from a wide variety of historical roots, not the least of which were the reciprocal influences between the New World and the small country in the earth of Europe. A comparison of these diverse roots reveals striking similarities that have made California and Switzerland so receptive to an exchange of our historical experiences. In the United States, the Protestant Anglo-Saxon immigrants established small fortified settlements that were therefore easy to manage simply in order to survive. These settlements fulfilled all the requirements for direct democratic self-government, where they were concentrated around one central location. Decisions could be taken at town meetings. If this was not feasible, then arrangements could be made in writing. The lack of monarch meant that the original immigrants and their descendants had to decide on all matters of importance themselves, and they had to do so democratically. And in the century that saw the widespread settlements of Midwest and Western America, those settlers had a lot of decisions to make. When, towards the end of the 19th century in California, the Southern Pacific Railroad Company began to dominate state politics and the justice system, a coalition of middle-class publishers, businessmen, and Freemasons known as the Progressives, was formed in opposition. The doctor and physicist John Randolph Haynes, husband of the suffragette Dora Haynes, founded the Direct Legislation League, which influenced the constitutions of the cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles. Prior to this, Haynes had visited Switzerland, small was thought to be beautiful even then, to study the direct democracy at work in my homeland. In 1904, shortly after the new city constitution of Los Angeles came into force, Recall John, as he was popularly known, for the first time petitioned successfully for the removal of an elected official. 6 years later, the Republican Hiram Warren Johnson was elected governor of California and committed himself wholeheartedly to the fight against the corruption. For a limited time, he had the support of a progressive parliamentary majority. This provided California with an area in which the direct democratic rights of referendum, popular initiative, and recall were introduced and endorsed by the overwhelming majority of the electorate in a vote on October 10, 1911. Swiss political science professor William Rappar, active in the U.S., who later became a national counselor in Switzerland, or equivalent of a representative, reported on these events in an essay entitled The Initiative, Referendum and Recall in Switzerland. This essay caused a sensation as it brought together the testimonies of numerous American champions of democratic rights, all of whom supported the claim made by Hendrick from Oregon that there would be no modern revival of the initiative and referendum had it not been for the Swiss example. But how had these rights developed in Switzerland? It certainly was not the case that large numbers of hopeful immigrants came there to settle. But in different ways, Switzerland had ample opportunities to work towards a practice of direct democracy in the course of several centuries. We can see how this evolved in several places, for instance, in the Alpine Valley of Glarus, where in the 14th century, local Bauernlandsgemeinden, like farmers' assemblies, were set up to debate the burning issues of the day. The participants, all men naturally, would debate and then decide whether they were more or less in favor of the one solution or the other for their communities. Small was indeed beautiful. Another development of direct democratic self-government came about by necessity in Switzerland in the 14th century. At that time, the lower nobility sank into poverty, and the farmers in many mountain villages truly recognized the predicament of their rulers. With great presence of mind, the farmers offered to pay their landlords 10 years of tax in 1 year in advance, if they were then discharged completely from paying any other further taxes. The noblemen were up to their necks in debt, and they readily accepted. The farmers scraped the money together, paid up, and were free. But now they had to manage their own affairs. And there the topography of Switzerland came to play an important part. The mountains, which protected the small communities from armed invaders and thus guaranteed independence, also presented a serious obstacle. How were the inhabitants of these regions to organize a democratic decision on whether to build a road linking to villages that were 2 miles apart as the crow flies, but separated by a mountain range, which meant that the journey on foot would take several days? In my own canton, Graubünden, the farmers devised a mechanism similar to the one which the fathers of the American Constitution chose 300 years later for the election of their president. In a central gathering, the village elders and scribes negotiated arrangements. The various village representatives would then put the related documents in their backpacks and take them home to their communities. In other words, literally, the arrangements had to be carried back, in Latin ad referendum, hence the name still in use today. The proposals would then be read out after church in the following Sunday to all men fit to bear arms, and these men would debate them. The proposals would then either be accepted as they were, rejected, or made subject to changes or conditions. All the village representatives then congregated again in the central location, compared the decisions of their villages and recorded the decision that were favored by the majority of the villages. In other words, if it had not been for the mountains, this federalist system of village referendums in Graubünden would not have come into being, and it has been working since about 400 years. But whereas many of these arrangements were in place without being fully institutionalized, a big change came about in 1798. France conquered Switzerland and liberated the French-speaking regions, most of which had until then been subject territories. As a result of the French Revolution, the moral values of great American political thinkers such as Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine found their way into Swiss hearts and minds, and these included the need for a written constitution, a collegial system for the executive, the concept of a constitutional referendum, the direct election by the people of the legislature and executive, a parliament with 2 chambers, and a declaration of fundamental rights and equality before the law. In the restoration period from 1830 onwards, this began to produce results. In fact, Switzerland has the American example to thank for helping it find an exit strategy in 1848 from its civil war, the so-called Sonderbund War, between the conservative Catholic cantons, favoring a loosest federation of states that would guarantee a large measure of independence, and the liberal Protestant cantons, who favored a much closer alliance. The solution to these impasses was the compromise of a federal state and, in particular, a bicameral parliament with one chamber representing the member states, the other reflecting the distribution of the population in the states. In this way, the stability of the Swiss constitutional system is a direct result of the American model. In a typically Swiss move, however, the compromise was further sweetened for the conservative minority by the decision to continue to refer to Switzerland in French and Italian, not as a federation, a federal state, but as a confederation, an alliance of states, a title that applies to this day. And the trick still works. In the fledging Swiss federal state, the pioneers of victory in the Civil War were the first to take charge, not altogether different from California, where it was the pioneers of the railroads, of mobility and of the economic boom. And while a future Swiss defense minister, one Emil Frey, was fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg as an officer on the Unionist side, my predecessor in the Federal Chancellery was making preparations for the first mandatory federal constitutional referendum. Also, at the same time, the democratic movement began in the cantons, a movement that was soon to oust the pioneers of the founding generation. One of them, by the way, was Alfred Escher, a railway baron and the founder of the bank that later became Credit Suisse. This cantonal movement succeeded in winning a range of new democratic rights, the popular initiative, the referendum, and the right to remove public authorities from power. It is thus interesting to reflect that quarter of a century later, when California's recall John studied the workings of direct democracy in Switzerland, he was in reality analyzing nothing less than the democratic evolution based on concept on town meetings by American pioneers. But that this American system had been able to gain a foothold in Switzerland was due to the fact that it had already existed in an early federalistic form of the referendum I mentioned earlier. Thus, it seems fair today that the interaction between the great US and little Switzerland, despite the differences in historical root causes, has triggered advances in both continents that can be seen today as a kind of dialogue. But despite the similarities, there are some interesting differences between the respective democratic rights in the two states, Switzerland and the US, or in this particular case, California. In California, democratic rights have become established as rights to counterbalance distrusted authorities. Although it would be legally possible, there are no preliminary considerations of popular initiatives in the political institutions, and their debate in government has never become an established procedure. By the same token, the authorities never work out counterproposal. If proposals are forthcoming, they are the result of popular initiatives of opposition groups in a civil society. Thus, Californian popular initiatives could be considered relatively confrontational and not aimed at achieving consensus or compromise. Also, they are never withdrawn, and they are completely successful in a third of all cases. Contradictions in the law due to the adoption of several opposition initiatives are avoided through a system in which the highest number of yes votes decides. In Switzerland, on the other hand, thanks to the referendum, a strong culture of consensus has developed. There is usually an institutionalized search for a compromise. This usually means that the authorities draw up direct counterproposals to most popular initiatives at constitutional level. Similarly, at statutory level, they draw up so-called indirect counterproposals. The counterproposals address the same concerns that led to the popular initiative in the first place, but they do so normally at the subsidiary statutory level. In practical terms, this means that behind the scenes, initiative committees and the authorities engage in a process of bargaining that may be hard, but it is also fair. As a result of the 58 popular initiatives dealt with in Switzerland in the past 15 years, in no less than 36 cases, there was an indirect counterproposal, and in a further 5, a direct counterproposal. 11 popular initiatives were ultimately withdrawn, while in California around a third of all popular initiatives are approved by the people, in Switzerland just under 10% win popular approval. The culture whereby the authorities attempt to accommodate the concerns expressed in popular initiatives often heads off a direct showdown. The initiative committees are often satisfied with the response of the institutions to address their concerns that they eventually withdraw their request. This concept, the possibility of withdrawing a popular initiative, was developed in Switzerland shortly before the introduction of democratic rights in California. However, Recall John visited too early to find out about this. Nevertheless, the essential consequence of this cultural difference is that considerably longer periods of time are allotted in Switzerland for the handling of popular initiatives. Moreover, the Federal Chancellery manages to avoid the situation in which two contradictory popular initiatives or other bills are put to a referendum at the same time. This is achieved without exercising any special powers, but simply by conducting an early analysis of the initiatives and the concern that created them, and by alerting the politicians to them. The result is that no internal contradictions can ever occur within the legal system. This is important because in Switzerland, popular initiatives, if they are accepted, always result in constitutional amendments. Let me come to some concluding observations. Often, Switzerland is regarded as the cradle of direct democracy. Nothing could be farther from the truth. To use a different but also nurturing image, Switzerland is not the mother, but the daughter of direct democracy. It is true to say that Switzerland has influenced some constitutional developments overseas, in California, not to mention Uruguay and Australia. Often, these developments have been based on personal connections that Swiss people had with the country concerned. But in the case of the US and California, the opposite applies. The Swiss constitutional reality of the 19th century was decisively influenced by American political thinkers and their experiences. They helped to originate the federal concept that enabled Switzerland to reshape the federalist referendum into direct democratic rights while preserving freedom. For, as we know, in both our countries, federalism brings freedom. So it is no longer a great surprise that, despite the enormous difference in size between the US and Switzerland or California on the one hand, all three have nonetheless enjoyed a comparable degree of political stability, albeit using slightly different strategies. The US Constitution, the oldest constitution of a sovereign state still in force, has been amended a total of 27 times in 233 years. Well over 10,000 attempts to amend it have failed. In Switzerland, by contrast, we have had a federal constitution since 1848. It was completely revised twice, once in 1874 and once in 1999. Over the same period, the federal constitution has been amended on around 200 occasions. This is quite striking. In its brevity and conciseness, the US Constitution expresses the stability of the political system. The Swiss Constitution is the opposite. It is probably the most unstable constitution in the world. permanently undergoing amendment, it nevertheless guarantees a stable state because the pressure to reform is constantly being reduced to what one could call homeopathic doses. As a result, if anyone in the U.S. wants a printed copy of the Constitution, they can buy it leather-bound, just like a Bible. In Switzerland, however, you are best advised to subscribe to the Swiss Federal Constitution like you would to a periodical. This is because potentially every 3 months a referendum will result in another amendment. Such frequent changes are all consequences of direct Swiss democracy and of the constant bargaining going on between groups putting forward initiatives and the authorities. Long ago, sadly, it seems that our Constitution has lost the brevity and consciousness of the U.S. Constitution. It is intriguing to consider, therefore, that what has emerged as a threat running through this talk for once applies not to something Swiss, but to something American. In terms of our respective constitutions, it is yours about which we can say small is beautiful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chancellor. It's now time for questions from the audience. So, you covered a lot of ground, and we have a wide range of very interesting questions here, which I have spread out in front of us. Excuse me. Let's start with some discussion on your direct democracy in Switzerland, and then we have some other interesting questions about governance more generally, and then we have a number of other questions related to public policy in Switzerland, and so we'll see whether we can get through all of these categories of questions. I thought it was interesting that you talked about your parliament being able to supplement a proposed amendment with a counter-proposal as a way to improve, to have this sort of this back and forth, this dialectic to improve the quality of the ultimate policy that is enacted. In California, the legislature can do the same thing, but they typically put a counter-proposal on a ballot to kill the original proposal because they know it will confuse voters. And voters tend to vote against measures that they are confused by pretty consistently. So it's interesting that it is used to a completely different effect in Switzerland.
Yes, maybe. Not only the parliament can make counter-proposals, but the government starts sometimes quite often to make a counter-proposal to an initiative. Mm-hmm. And the parliament can even change that one. Mm-hmm. And we have large debates in both chambers, and it can also take quite a lot of time. And the government and also parliament, they want to win a situation. Mm-hmm. So they want to make a counter-proposal that might satisfy mm-hmm. the initiative, the people who take the initiatives. Mm-hmm. And that's also the reason why sometimes they withdraw the initiative. If they are satisfied, quite satisfied, because when we have a popular vote, everybody wants to win a vote. Popular vote, and they don't want to be a loser. So if they are quite satisfied, so they can withdraw the initiative.
And I think it could tell us again, what is the likelihood of an initiative passing on your ballot? Do they typically pass or do they typically fail?
They fail. They typically most of them fail. 90% fail.
Okay, that's what you said, 10%
only
pass.
Only 10% are accepted. Since 1848 up to now, only 17 initiatives have been accepted.
But there's still a very strong incentive and motivation to try to get them to pass.
Yes, and this system with the counter-proposals make that there is a solution can be found. found. The initiative in Switzerland always changes the constitution. And to win a popular vote, you need a double majority, majority of the people and also the majority of the cantons. It is very, very, very hard to win this kind of initiative. And when they make a counter proposal, they can make it or on the constitutional basis or on a legal basis that changes a law. So, and there you need, but to win the popular vote, you need only the single majority.
Okay.
So this is the reason why.
So another challenge with the initiative process in California is something that's often referred to as ballot box budgeting. And that happens when there are measures put on the ballot that have a cost. And they pass, voters pass them because they like the policy. But they end, as a result, they tie up general fund money in the budget to pay for the sort of one-off policy or program, which ties the hands of the legislature when they're trying to balance the budget. And as our audience knows, and you may have heard, we are now over 90 days late in passing a budget. We're in the process of breaking a new state record for a delayed budget, and some think that the legislature may just bump it to the next governor in January and just take a pass, which is extraordinary. But, you know, in a climate where balancing a budget and managing our finances is just completely dysfunctional, what's referred to as ballot box budgeting really exacerbates the problem or is perceived to. How do you pay for measures? Are they policies that have a cost? How do you manage that?
Yes, we have always to be transparent and say how much a measure does cost. But the parliament is the last one, is responsible for the budget. We don't have a referendum or an initiative, a right for initiative to change the budget. It is by the parliament.
Okay.
So, and it always passes. The government has to present the budget in August, and it passes in parliament in both chambers in December for the next year. So we have always this budget.
That's good.
There is no controversial in with a popular vote.
Okay, got it. So I'm going to broaden the questioning a little bit. I noticed that Zurich and Geneva have respectively been ranked as the cities with the second and third highest quality of living in the world, which is fascinating. And one of the questions that we have here from the audience is, what's the connection between economic wealth and federalism in your mind? Is there a connection there?
Well, yes, federalism, we are a small country. We have 26 cantons, small ones, and they are very independent, as I told at the beginning. So they can also decide about their budget, about their taxes, about the school system, about the welfare system, about the sanitation system, so the health system, and it gives a lot of independence and freedom to these cantons. And Geneva and Zurich are our cities in Switzerland, well known. Zurich is the economic center in Switzerland, and Geneva is the international city in Switzerland with a high standard. What they offer is also a security in Switzerland that we have, in not only in these two cities, but all over, and also a cultural system with you have operas and you have concerts and you have everything, and also with the languages. We have languages, English schools in Zurich and in Geneva, and I think for many people this is also attracting to go to live and to work in Switzerland in these two places. We have also a high developed system of public transportation, and many people commute by train and not by car. So you know when you leave and you know when you arrive, and when you take the car, sometimes you don't know when you get to a place.
So You have a two-house system. You have the Council of States and the National Council, as you described. It's a parliamentary system or a modified parliamentary system, perhaps. What do you think some of the most interesting contrasts are between your system and Congress in the U.S.?
It is. We copied the system of the U.S. Actually, it is the same system because they have the same powers. An amendment has to pass both chambers, the National Council and the Council of States, okay. The Senate. So it is very, very important. And since the Senate is composed of two members of each canton, the small cantons, we have very small ones. I told you Appenzell with only about 15,000 inhabitants, and Zurich is much bigger. So this is also a kind to correct the majority system, the simple majority system, because we have the cantons on the land-hand side, we don't have that much income on this on these areas. The income comes more from the big cities, from the surroundings, from this part. So it is important that you have a kind of to establish, also to correct this system by the double majority in the two chambers. But it is the same like in the U.S.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We have a number of questions regarding the cost of politics. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. and in California, being involved in politics, whether as a candidate, someone who wants to run for office, as an incumbent, someone who's been in office and wants to stay there to finish their agenda, or just as a voter who wants to be able to have a voice, it's very, very expensive. The initiative process is extraordinarily expensive in California. It costs $1.5 million simply to get a measure on the ballot, and the cost of a campaign can range from, you know, the bottom dollar campaign is $3 to $5 million up to $30-40 million for a typical campaign. It's extremely expensive. We've got a question about the pressure on elected officials to fundraise, to spend tremendous amounts of their time fundraising. And then another question asking about the volunteer nature of members in the Swiss government. How does money influence politics in Switzerland?
That might be different as in the United States. In Switzerland, it is not that expensive. We have about 3 to 4 times a year we have popular votes. And if you want to have an initiative, you need 100,000 signatures. It's always the same amount, 100,000 signatures, mm-hmm. in order to change the constitution. It depends on the political groups, the parties. Sometimes we have also the unions. They start initiatives, but they can get these 100,000 signatures. They go into the road and are collecting the signatures. For a referendum, we need only 50,000 signatures. It is to change when Parliament decided about a law. And some groups think, no, we won't accept this law, so they collect 50,000 signatures in order to force a popular vote. This does not cost that much. Mm-hmm. And about the funds, the fundraising for elections, most people in Switzerland don't have that much funds in order to organize an election. And we have also, we don't have a professional parliament. Our politicians, they work. They work as a lawyer. They work as a they have a work at home. They are politicians only 50% of their time. Mm-hmm. So it is quite different, and they don't earn that much. They earn the national councillors, the councillors of states. It depends on how many committees they are working, but they earn at about 70,000 Swiss francs. It's the same $70,000. They don't have that many privileges. They don't have assistant people. They have to do their work by themselves. Mm-hmm. The federal councillors, the governor, the members of government, they earn more, about 440,000 Swiss francs. I think it's the same like the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. and they do it professionally. Mm-hmm. They're full-time member of the government. Volunteers, we have volunteers also, people who are working for the parties and for the unions, and they are also collecting signatures or like that. And mm-hmm. the participation of on the popular votes, it depends on the question, is about, we had last Sunday, 10 days ago, we had a popular vote. The participation was only about 35%. It's not mm-hmm. very high. Mm-hmm. But the average in the last years was about 45%.
And that was another, that was the next question I was going to ask, actually had to do with voter turnout. So you've got, you have four elections a year, typically, you
Votations,
say, right?
Yeah.
And turnout, so the most recently it was 30%, and normally you say 45, is that what you said? So mm-hmm. less than 50%. So that would be considered very low turnout here. Here in the U.S., good turnout is considered, you know, if you're in the 60s, mm-hmm. you know, probably 65, that's pretty mm-hmm. good, and 50 is bad. And a 30%, 30, 40% turnout is considered very, very, very low. So do you interpret the numbers differently? I mean, they mean
no.
different to you.
No, but it depends on the subjects. Mm-hmm. Where people go to the polling stations if they are concerned about the question, about the political question, about the health system, about the pensions, or about the... We do also make votations about the streets, about the tunnels sometimes, but not all the people are concerned in the same way, so... It is maybe this is the reason mm-hmm. for the elections. We have the participation is higher than for the vote, popular votes.
How many measures do you typically have on a ballot, on a single ballot?
It depends. It depends. Last time we had only one topic. Sometimes we try to combine three or four. We have deadlines also when the subject have to be presented to the people. Mm-hmm. There are deadlines of 10 months after the government decided or 10 months after the parliament decided. So we have mm-hmm. to do, and we have four times a year. We know already when these votations take place.
Okay. So you, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. You, you said you have four official languages in Switzerland. And I think all of government is conducted in all four languages. Is that right? Or how do you do that? I mean, this is a great interest in California.
Yes. Actually, we have 3.5 official languages. The Romance language, my mother tongue, is just a half an official language. The other ones are German, French, and Italian. And in the government, we have five people speak German and two speak French, and everybody is speaking in his language or her language. The other ones are supposed to understand this language. There is no translation, but they do understand everything.
Great. And I'm going to stop and do a radio announcement here. I'm Zabre Valentine, former director of the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform Project and current deputy director of California Forward, which addresses governance issues in the state of California. And we're moderating, and I'm moderating the question and answer portion of this program with Federal Chancellor of Switzerland, Mrs. Karina Casanova. So we are, I think, globally discovering all of the ways in which digital communication, whether it's online, cell phones in a lot of the world, can really transform democracy and participation, as well as increasing transparency of governance and management day to day. How is digital technology being used in, or e-government being used in Switzerland? And where do you see it going?
We are also working on this subject in Switzerland for the government. Actually, in the Federal Chancellery, we do organize the e-voting system for the people living in Switzerland, but basically now we are on a project for the expatriates, the Swiss citizens who are living abroad. and they can participate on the votations we have, and we make this e-voting system by a remote system on the internet system. So we try to go on step by step, because we have always to make sure that the security is given for this system. So now, for the moment, part of the expatriates can participate on it. We will go on with the people who cannot see, because they will be able the first time to vote, or with the secret vote. This is very important. And we work also on the e-government, because it is very important for all citizens that they can also have all this information. We have a lot of information that can be also seen on the screen. Actually, at the Chancellor, we publish once a week the official publications in the three official languages, in French, Italian, and German, at the same time. And it is important that they can also consult it straight on, in, and not to wait until they get it on a paper. And the same thing has to be done also in the 26 cantons, because they have also their own laws, like you know it here also. But we know that we have to go on with that, but it's not that easy in Switzerland.
So I'm going to ask you one more question related to electoral process, and then ask some other more broad questions. So I think you mentioned in your remarks that Switzerland has a four-party system, four political parties, four main political parties, is that right?
We have more than that. It is open one.
Many more than that.
Yes.
Okay. And I think you have you use proportional representation.
Yes.
Is that right? This is also something that a lot of Californians are very curious mm-hmm. about. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about how that works?
Well, it means that in the most cases in the cantons, when you have the elections for the national councillors and for most of the senators, you have a proportional system. It means that you can make coalitions with other parties. We have many parties in Switzerland, about 12 parties, and when you make these coalitions, it depends on which place you are. So it is not only the majority, the one who has the most electoral voices that can win, but it depends on the coalition with the parties you make. So it can change a little bit, also the proportion. At the government, we have seven members, seven federal councillors, and they represent five different parties. And it means that they have always to find a coalition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you feel the system works well? Would you
yes.
recommend it?
Yes, yes, it works well.
So you may have heard a little bit about the debates over the last year on healthcare reform mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. What do you think of what you've heard about U.S. healthcare reform, and how do they compare with the Swiss system of universal coverage?
Mm-hmm. In Switzerland, we had the same debate about 15 years ago, and we introduced also this compulsory healthcare system. Everybody has to have insurance for the healthcare, and she can also have private security in addition to the basic security system. I think we are a wealthy country in Switzerland, and we have a high developed healthcare system in Switzerland, good surgery, but it costs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, the federal councillor who is in charge of the healthcare system, he has to announce the increase of the fees, what they have to pay for this insurance system. It costs a lot. Basically, for the middle-standing families, it is very, very expensive. But we have also a very, very good system all over for everybody in Switzerland.
How do you handle maternal care when moms are having children, and then how do you deal with child care? Do you have state child care? How does that work? Do women go back to work? How long are they off?
There, we cannot be that proud on this matter. We introduced mother leave only a few years ago. Before, the women who had a child, they had to be, they were considered as sick if they were staying at home. Now they have a leave of 4 months after they had a child, and we don't have a system in order that children can go and can be looked after. It depends on a private basis how the women can be organized to do that. So we are now we have five federal councillors, five female federal councillors in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And it's four.
Things?
We have four. Excuse me. Yeah, mm-hmm. We have four. With myself, we are five of eight. And we started. The women had the right to vote only since 1971. It means also that we are a little bit conservative country. So also the matter to have children and to look after the children when before they go to school, it means also that we have still a work to do on this subject.
So do we. So that's all right.
Yeah.
We'll be hand in hand on that one. So the banking system has been under fire in the United States and I think globally in the last couple of years mm-hmm. now due to the economic crisis. What is Switzerland learned through this process? What's being talked about? Do you think there should be more transparency in Swiss banking, more regulation? What are you guys doing that we should know about?
Yeah. We had to go also to big trouble with these questions in the last few months in Switzerland. What we did is that we opened also a little bit the transparency system in Switzerland, like the OECD Article 26 of the amendment. And I think this is we had to go. The pressure was in that way that we have to go to this. And we will see how we will go on in the future.
Great. So it's the time has come that we've reached the point in our program when we have time for only one last question. And I'm looking at the one that says, what is Roger Federer like? I'm not going to ask that as your last question. I was going to. I wrote end on it, but I'm not going to. I'm going to be more high-minded because this is the Commonwealth Club after all. And instead, I'm going to ask, why has Switzerland refrained from joining the European Union? And do you think this has been beneficial to the Swiss economy? How boring.
Well, about the European Union, Switzerland is not part, is not a member of the European Union, and it will not be for the next few years, I guess. We have always discussions, we have popular votes about this question. For the moment, the Swiss people prefer the bilateral agreements with the European Union because they are afraid to lose power and decision power in Switzerland. And I think also in the economical questions, most of the Swiss people might think that they would lose also mm-hmm. economically power.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you so much, Madam
Thank
Chancellor.
You.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California, please join me in thanking Mrs. Karina Casanova, Federal Chancellor of Switzerland.
Thank you. Thank you.
We also would like to thank our audience here, as well as on the radio and the internet. I'm Zabre Valentine, and now this joint meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California is adjourned.
Thank you.